The house had been quite the show home. It had been badly neglected, though, and by the time we bought it, it had fallen into serious disrepair. The pool didn't hold water, and weeds grew 6 feet tall through the cracks on the tennis court. The house had a leaky roof and several broken windows, creating easy access routes for the hundreds of ground squirrels, voles, and mice that had taken up residence in and around the house. The property was too much for us, given our income, but it was surrounded by breathtaking scenery. The extraordinary light in the foothills made the rocks behind our house glow a fiery orange in the mornings, and a sweet, deep lavender at dusk. Set among the massive pink sandstone cliffs were twisted, gnarly scrub oaks, bristling prickly pears, and spiky yucca, hardy desert survivors every one. The boys and I would sit and watch the wildlife from our picture windows, like other families watch television. Scrub jays, flickers, magpies, and chickadees patronized our bird feeders, and deer families and foxes and raccoons shared whatever seeds spilled to the ground. We hosted a family of bobcats in our backyard for a while. One night after dinner, Tom looked up from doing the dishes to see a black bear staring right back at him through the kitchen window, not 18 inches away. One morning, he saw another bear blissfully lying on his back in the middle of our swimming pool, soaking in a depression in the pool cover that had trapped just enough water for his bath. One of our neighbors told me the land used to be a wintering ground for a local Native American tribe, and the property had a spiritual feel to it. I had wanted my boys to grow up safely surrounded by the beauty of nature, to roam free in a place that would reward their imaginations. When we found the house in the foothills, as decrepit and neglected as it was, I believed we'd found that place. We moved in early December of 1989, when Dylan was in third grade. A friendly neighbor gave us an old mini-bike from his garage, and Tom found a second one, used, in the newspaper classifieds. He and the boys rebuilt the bikes to get them running, and before long, Dylan and Byron had worn trails throughout our property. They had tremendous freedom to roam. On the other hand, the new house was so remote that their activities in town had to be scheduled so Tom or I could provide transportation. The boys couldn't simply get on their bikes to visit friends or ride to the corner for an ice cream. Our relative isolation in the country meant the two boys spent a great deal of time together. As he grew, Dylan took a lot of pride in his independence. To my amusement, he asked me to show him how to do his own laundry when he was 10. That independence, combined with the determination we'd seen when he was young, made him a force to be reckoned with. I remember taking him and Byron to the roller rink. I wasn't an accomplished skater by any stretch of the imagination, but I could stay on my feet, and I offered to help Dylan, who was struggling to stay on his. He insisted he could do it alone, and so I dutifully planted myself against the railing as he stumbled away from me. He took a few halting steps on his skates, without gliding, and then fell hard to the floor. I rushed to help, but he waved me off impatiently. "I can skate. You wait here and watch. Don't move. I don't need help." And so I watched as he crawled on his hands and knees to the railing and pulled himself up. Then he took another few awkward steps before falling again. I held myself back and watched as the tiny figure inched around the huge rink. A few hesitant steps, the inevitable fall, and then the laborious crawl back to the railing. I have absolutely no idea how long it took him to go all the way around. It felt like an hour. Finally, he lurched up to where I stood. Sweat poured from his face, and tendrils of blonde hair stuck to his forehead. I winced to think about the bruises covering his legs under his dusty jeans. Holding the wall to steady himself, his legs shaking with the effort to keep himself upright after all that work, he stood tall and proud in front of me. "See? I told you I could skate." Incidents like this convinced Tom and me that Dylan would be able to accomplish anything he set out to do, if only by sheer force of will. This was the foundation of our belief in him. He had a lot of confidence in himself, and we did too. Dylan spent 4th, 5th, and 6th grades in a gifted classroom. It was almost a private school setting, small classes, lots of chess and math games, and individual attention. By the end of 6th grade, challenged academically and spending his days with kids who shared his interests, Dylan seemed to be on top of the world. He left a record of the confidence he felt in a drawing. A boy in a plaid shirt standing on top of a range of yellow, green, and purple mountains, waving to the viewer with a huge smile on his face. The principal of his elementary school chose the picture for the school's permanent collection, framed it with a gold nameplate, and hung it in the hallway. After Columbine, afraid someone would destroy or steal it, we asked his favorite teacher to return it to us. One of the traits that marked Dylan throughout his life was an exaggerated reluctance to risk embarrassment, something that intensified as he entered adolescence. Both Tom and I are self-deprecating by nature, the first ones to poke fun at ourselves. But Dylan did not laugh easily at his own foibles. He could be unforgiving of himself when he failed at anything, and he hated to look foolish. One summer afternoon when Dylan was about 8, we went on a picnic with Judy Brown and her 2 boys. The kids were catching crayfish in the creek, and Dylan lost his balance on the slippery rocks and fell into the shallow water with a splash. He emerged unhurt but furious, livid about the pratfall, and even angrier that everyone else had laughed. We tried to help him see the humor in it. Byron would likely have hammed it up further by taking an elaborate bow. But Dylan went to the car and refused to speak to anyone until he felt able to face the world again. The reaction seemed outsized, but it only cemented what we already knew. Dylan felt embarrassment more acutely than other kids did. When he was about 10 and a cousin was visiting from out of state, she and the boys and I went horseback riding together. Midway through our ride, Dylan's horse stopped in the middle of the trail to pee. Childishly, the rest of us laughed. Dylan's face grew red and hot with embarrassment, his humiliation growing with every passing second. Still, while Dylan might have been more self-conscious than Byron had been, his insecurities still fell well within normal parameters for a preteen. By junior high, the gifted program Dylan was in had come to an end. Like many kids that age, he was excruciatingly conscious of anything that might make him stand out from the crowd. In junior high, he told me, it wasn't cool to be smart. Despite this, he continued to do well academically. By the time he was in 8th grade, his junior high math teacher recommended he enroll in an algebra class at Columbine High School. Dylan refused to go. All 3 of us met with his teacher to weigh the pros and cons. It's intimidating enough to start high school as a 9th grader, let alone to go there a year early, and the logistics of getting him back and forth safely were complicated. Together, we concluded it would be best to let Dylan stay at the junior high for math. It was a relief to us that Dylan was doing well because Byron's entry into adolescence had been challenging. He needed a great deal of parental poking and prodding to get through his daily routines. We'd established clear expectations for the boys when they were young. They were never permitted to speak to us or to any adult in a disrespectful way. We asked them to care for their rooms and belongings and to help us with projects around the house. I expected them to do what they could to stay safe, wear sunscreen, drive responsibly, and say no to drugs. On top of that, they were required to keep up with their schoolwork. And so when Tom and I saw Byron's high school academic performance, never stellar, decline, we searched his room and discovered he was smoking marijuana. Marijuana is legal in Colorado now, so our reaction might seem old-fashioned and outsized. But drugs had never been a part of either of our lives, and we were frankly afraid of them. We'd been pretty closely monitoring Byron's movements before, but after we found the pot, we got right up on top of him. We searched his room as a matter of routine. We insisted he end friendships we believed weren't in his best interests. We sent him to see a counselor. I'm sure we annoyed him beyond measure, but Byron had the same good-natured, loving spirit as always. He was funny and open, and I'd spent hours in his room talking to him, making sure he was okay. There wasn't a lot of conflict in the house, but Byron was definitely receiving the lion's share of our parental attention, which may have meant we did not recognize the intensity of Dylan's emerging needs. During those trying years, Dylan kept doing what he was supposed to be doing. He seemed to enjoy the role of the cooperative, responsible child, the kid who did the right thing. And Tom and I needed him to fulfill that role more than ever when we were preoccupied with Byron's welfare. Dylan's commitment to self-reliance obscured how much he needed help at the end of his life. It unquestionably contributed to our inability to see him as troubled. In the summer after eighth grade, Dylan began to develop the lean, angular look he'd have for the rest of his life. We wanted to reward his transition into high school, so we offered to send him to a summer camp in the mountains. The camp was rustic, and the kids shouldered the majority of what needed to be done to keep the place running. Dylan never hesitated to complain at home when he felt he'd been assigned more than his fair share of chores. But he had no complaints about camp. He loved being outdoors, and the counselors told us he got along well with the other kids. Both of our sons played baseball from the time they were small. The sport was the common thread woven through their childhoods and adolescence. They watched games on television, fought over the sports pages, and took turns going to baseball games with their father. Tom loved the game, and the three of them would spend summer nights playing catch in the backyard or throwing balls through a plywood sheet Tom had customized for pitching practice. Dylan's walls were covered with posters of his baseball heroes, Lou Gehrig, Roger Clemens, Randy Johnson. One of our favorite movies was The Natural, which starred Robert Redford as a baseball prodigy. The boys watched it so often that they knew parts by heart. Baseball was not only a wholesome pastime for the boys, it was a shared love between Tom's family and my own. One of my grandfathers had been asked to join a professional team as a young man. He declined. He didn't want to leave his widowed mother. And both Tom's father and his brother played amateur ball well into their adult years. I loved that our boys played this classic American sport, just as their grandfathers and great-grandfathers had before them. Both Dylan and Tom were devastated when Dylan, entering Columbine High School as a ninth grader, didn't make the Columbine High School baseball team. Byron's smooth right-handed pitch kept him in the game until he grew tired of it. Dylan also pitched, but he was a lefty and fired the ball like a cannon, trying to strike the batter out. Throwing hard was his trademark, and he often sacrificed accuracy for speed. In time, his pitching style took its toll on his arm. The summer before Dylan went into eighth grade, Tom hired a coach to help both boys with their form. During one of their sessions, Dylan seemed to be struggling. Suddenly, he stopped throwing altogether, his eyes downcast. Tom hurried over, worried he or the coach had pushed Dylan too hard. He saw Dylan's eyes were filled with tears. "My arm hurts too much to pitch," Dylan told his dad. Tom was shocked. Dylan had never mentioned any pain before, though we later learned it had been going on for months, worsening with each throw. It was typical of Dylan not to mention it. He'd been determined to overcome the problem by force of will. Tom took him to the doctor immediately. Dylan had a painful inflammation around the tendons of the elbow, and the doctor recommended he take a break from baseball. He stayed away until the following summer, when he began to practice for the Columbine High School baseball team tryouts. Tom had also begun to experience serious joint pain. Right around the time Dylan was entering high school, Tom was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and would undergo surgeries on his knees and shoulders in the next few years. His ability to help Dylan practice was limited, as he could no longer throw a ball, so he hired the pitching coach to come back. As it turned out, Dylan's arm was still sore. The day of the tryouts, the two of them made quite a pair. Dylan favoring his elbow, and Tom's knees hurting so badly he could barely walk out to the field. Given his injury, we greeted the news that Dylan hadn't made the team with mixed emotions. Although disappointed he wouldn't be participating in a sport in high school, neither Tom nor I wanted to push him into an activity that might cause him lasting physical damage. As a family, we tried to minimize the loss and move on. For his part, Dylan claimed he hadn't liked some of the kids on the team anyway. His passion for the sport didn't come to an end. He still followed professional baseball religiously and went occasionally to games with his dad. In time, he'd join a fantasy baseball league. Not making the team was a much greater loss than we knew, though, as the focus of his attention shifted from baseball to computers. Dylan and Byron weren't eligible for bus service to Columbine High School, so Tom or I had to drop them off and pick them up. When Dylan began ninth grade, we worked out a plan that honored his growing sense of independence. After school, he would take the city bus a couple of miles to the college where I worked and stay with me until it was time to go home. I loved having Dylan at my office with me while I worked. I kept a file drawer full of snacks for him, which often went unopened because the women in my department spoiled him with homemade treats. If his homework was done, he'd head to the student lounge to watch television, or to the cafeteria for a milkshake. Occasionally, he'd stretch his long legs out under a table in my office to take a nap. When he was a sophomore, he volunteered at the daycare on campus. The director was a colleague of mine, and I'd occasionally stop by to watch him work. True to form, Dylan would be out there on the playground, making sure the little kids were lining up neatly to get a turn on the swing. Every mother worries about the social aspects of high school, but I was less worried than most. Dylan was tall and geeky and never part of that top rung of the social hierarchy reserved for athletes, but his social life flourished in high school. He had three close friends with whom he spent most of his free time. On any given weekend, one of them was at our house or Dylan was at one of theirs. The four of them, Dylan, Zach, Nate, and Eric, had other friends, too, but these were the kids we considered Dylan's inner circle. Dylan met Nate, the boy I always considered his closest friend, in junior high school. Nate was an only child raised by his mother and stepfather. Like Dylan, Nate was gangly, tall and thin, with long, dark lashes and black hair. Unlike Dylan, though, he was effusive and happy to talk a mile a minute about everything under the sun. In the early years of their friendship, the two of them spent most of their free time outdoors, playing catch and other games. Nate handily outplayed Dylan in basketball, but Dylan beat him soundly when they played pool back at our house. When Nate spent the night, the boys would stay up late, playing pool or video games, or trying out recipes from late-night cooking shows. Dylan was famous, even among the voracious adolescents he hung out with, for his appetite. He was adventurous, too. When his friends came out with us for dinner, they'd usually stick with the fried standards, while Dylan experimented with calamari or barbecued duck. Nate spent a lot of time at our house. He was the first one on his feet to help if I came in carrying groceries or laundry, and quick to compliment my cooking. I'm happiest when I have a full house, and never complained when a group of teenagers descended upon my kitchen like locusts, although our house was sufficiently remote that it didn't happen very often. Dylan met his friend Zach freshman year. Zach's dad was a university professor turned administrator, and his mom ran the children's youth group at the church we'd attended when the boys were younger. Zach was friendly and outgoing, with a stocky build, a round face, and short brown hair. His house was ground zero for all kinds of zany activity. Someone always seemed to be barbecuing or going boating or throwing a pool party, and Dylan spent a lot of time there. I was especially pleased by Dylan's friendship with Zach because of how gregarious and outgoing Zach was. He didn't mind being the center of attention, which drew Dylan out a little. Both Zach and Dylan were interested in technology. One summer, they hit rummage sales in Zach's neighborhood for old telephone equipment, determined to build a portable telephone system. This was before cell phones. The boys were proud of the contraption they came up with. An old telephone bolted to a sprung suitcase, and they got it working well enough to cause some static on the phone system in our house. It was Zach who got Dylan interested in doing sound tech for theater productions at the end of their sophomore year. After watching a production of Bye Bye Birdie, I visited Dill in the sound booth and was impressed by his command of the many switches and levers on the complicated board. Dylan loved it. He spent hours at rehearsals and experimented with manipulating sounds on his computer to make an original soundtrack for a production of Frankenstein directed by his friend Brooks. People occasionally approached him to run the sound system for their talent shows, church events, and less formal after-school productions. Zach was the first of Dylan's friends to have a girlfriend. Dylan was jealous of his friend's good fortune, but nonetheless became friends with Zach's girlfriend, Devin. After Dylan's death, Devin made a book of photographs and stories about him for me. What struck me was how much she trusted in and confided in Dylan. When her feelings were hurt, or when she had conflicts with others, it was Dylan she turned to for support. She wrote, "I would call Dylan on the phone or talk to him on the computer. It was the best therapy I could hope for. Dylan was the best listener I had ever met." Eric was the fourth member of the crew. Dylan and Eric had also met in junior high school. Eric's dad had been in the military, and he'd retired to the Denver area. The family was still quite new there when Eric and Dylan met. We met the Harrises when the boys started hanging out, and we liked them, although we didn't see them socially. At the end of eighth grade, Dylan and Eric were both recognized for their achievement in math. When they walked up to the stage to accept their awards, I whispered to Tom that they looked like two peas in a pod. This was before Dylan's growth spurt. In junior high, Dylan and Eric watched tons of movies together and loved to go bowling. One time, they built a contraption to launch potatoes from one side of a pocket park to another. As they grew older, they added to their interests an attraction to girls, computer games, and music, as well as baseball games and concerts. In high school, Eric remained small and relatively slight, while Dylan shot up in height. Eric was older and got his license before Dylan. Their friendship didn't seem any more intense than Dylan's relationships with other boys. If anything, I would have said that Dylan was closer to Nate. It did seem more private somehow. I never felt as close to Eric as I did to Nate and Zach, although he was always respectful and perfectly polite when he was around Tom and me. I don't remember him asking me any questions or volunteering ridiculous stories about Dylan the way Zach and Nate did, but he was clearly smart, friendly, and funny. Perhaps it's significant I don't have the same kinds of memories of connecting with Eric that I do with Dylan's other friends. I wonder how much of that has to do with spending time with Zach and Nate after Dylan's death, and the fact that I had the privilege of seeing them as they grew into adulthood. I still talk to Nate. He checks in with me at holiday time and comes to visit when he's in town. I do know that we did not perceive there to be anything unusual or unsettling about Eric, or about his friendship with Dylan prior to the trouble they had near the end of junior year, or Tom and I would not have permitted it to continue. Dylan didn't have a girlfriend in high school, but he and his other friends did hang out with girls. Herd dating was common among their age group. He met his prom date, Robin, in class. They studied calculus together. When Dylan first started spending time with Robin, I peppered him with questions about her and her family, as I did about all of his friends. He laughed. "Believe me, Mom, you have nothing to worry about with Robin. She's exactly the kind of person you'd want me to be with, an A student." When I asked what she was like, Dylan shrugged and told me, "She's just a nice person." I met her a few days later and realized Dylan had been right. Robin was lovely. I was impressed by how comfortable she seemed around Tom and me. Before Dylan and his friends could drive, it was easy to interact with them and get to know their parents because the boys needed transportation in order to get together. Tom and I always stopped in to say hi to the other parents and to coordinate plans when we were dropping Dylan off. It made me feel good to know we could speak freely with one another about our children if we had concerns, though we almost never had cause. When Dylan and his friends were old enough to work, his closest friends ended up working at Blackjack Pizza. Zach got a job there first, Dylan joined him a little while after, and Eric and Nate after that. Dylan bragged about his ability to make a great pizza quickly. When paychecks started rolling in, I helped him open checking and savings accounts at the bank. And after he died, I found neat folders containing his bank statements, payment stubs, and tax information. Tom or I would drop him off and pick him up from work if he couldn't get a ride from one of his friends. We both got a kick out of calling to find out what time he needed to be picked up. It was the only time we got to hear Dylan's professional customer service voice. Dylan's high school grades ebbed and flowed with his level of enthusiasm for the subject and the teacher. It disappointed us that he was not fulfilling his academic potential as he had in elementary school. On the other hand, I was relieved to see him lighten up. When he was younger, Dylan's perfectionism had frustrated him and sometimes frustrated us, although I could relate. So I didn't mind when his orderly room turned into the more typical teenage sty. He'd eventually find areas of interest he'd excel in, just as Tom and I had. My own grades had been mediocre until graduate school. I have since learned that perfectionism is frequently a characteristic of kids with special abilities. Ironically, it can sometimes undermine their potential. A mistake or setback that most kids would shrug off can devastate a child with unrealistic and unattainable standards. It can lower their self-esteem, causing them to disengage from the intellectual challenges that once fired them up. In retrospect, I believe that Dylan's innate perfectionism and our inability to help him manage his unrealistic expectations for himself contributed to his feelings of alienation at the end of his life. Dylan planned to major in computer science at college. Like his dad, he loved to tinker, and they did a lot of that together, customizing speakers and fixing up cars. He and Tom also liked to play pranks on one another, like setting each other's computer to surprise the user with obnoxious sounds when the machine was turned on, such as a dog singing a Christmas carol. In 10th grade, Dylan built his own computer. He and his friends liked playing video games and experimenting with visual and audio effects. Eventually, he became a beta tester for Microsoft products. I often referred to him as a computer geek. I would have preferred it if he and his friends had spent more time outside, especially because we live near some of the best hiking and skiing and snowboarding terrain in the world. But neither Tom nor I thought Dylan's time on the computer was inherently bad. His social life did not suffer, and he'd reluctantly pull himself away to go out for dinner or watch a movie with us if we asked him to. Neither of us saw the computer as a tool for destructive or malicious behavior. If we had, we would not have allowed him to use it. That said, Tom and I did not look at what Dylan did on his computer. This seems shockingly naive now, but it was a different time. And anyway, I would not have known how to check his browser history or usage in those days. I had only just begun using the Internet myself. I did find excuses to go in and out of Dylan's room so I could take a peek at what he was up to. One time he was in a chat room, and he looked edgy when I peered over his shoulder. When I asked him to translate the jargon, it sounded like typical and dumb teenage conversation. I knew sexual images were readily available on the Internet and assumed they'd appeal to him, as they would to most teenage boys, although I never discovered him looking at any. Even if I had been aware of dangerous content online, I would never have suspected Dylan to be interested in material that would lead him to hurt himself or anybody else. Byron had no desire to go to college, at least not immediately. Tom and I didn't want to be in conflict with him over our rules, no drinking, drugs, or smoking cigarettes on our property, for starters, but we worried, too, that Byron would struggle in a less structured environment. After endless conversations, Tom and I went with Byron to see his counselor. The counselor asked Byron outright if he was ready to hold down a job and an apartment by himself, and Byron assured him he was. For our part, we could only hope the demands of real life would help him mature. With the counselor's blessing, Byron and his best friend rented a cheap apartment across town, and the two of them set off from our house in a pickup truck loaded down with spare furniture, kitchen utensils, and a few boxes of food. Ever the optimist, I even included cleaning supplies. Dylan couldn't wait to move into his brother's room, which was bigger and had more windows. Redecorating was a family affair. Tom and I replaced the sliding closet doors with mirrored ones, so the room looked twice as big as it had before. Dylan requested that one wall be painted a sleek black, which looked sharp with the modern black furniture Byron had left behind. Dylan put his computer against the dark wall and covered the rest of the room with posters. Tom hung a shelf over the computer so that Dylan would have a place for his CDs and attached a fluorescent light to the underside. For me, Dylan moving into Byron's room marked the end of his childhood. Even though he was over 6 feet tall, I watched with sadness as he packed up boxes of toys from his own room and labeled them for storage. After his death, I opened boxes filled with his once precious Lego sets. Most contained the original packaging and instructional diagrams, nearly torn along the folds from use. I was struck by how like Dylan that was, to meticulously organize even the things he was putting away for storage. Around the time he moved into his brother's old room, Dylan got his learner's permit. As difficult as it was for us to watch him take this next step away from us, we were glad, too. His friends had always been generous with rides, but we lived a good 15 or 20 minutes out of their way, and it had been annoying for him to be the only person in his group of friends too young to drive. At first, Tom took Dylan to empty parking lots in the evening to get the feel of driving the car. Then they worked their way up to driving on city streets, freeways, and finally the twisting mountain roads. The first time we went to Byron's new apartment for dinner, we allowed Dylan to drive us halfway. Byron proudly presented us with a double batch of hamburger helper. Anticipating a shortage of vegetables on the menu, I'd brought a salad. By August, Dylan was taking driving lessons so he could get a lower auto insurance rate. The process leading up to Byron's move had been painful, but once we saw him settled in his new apartment, we knew it was the right decision. "Now we can focus on Dylan," I told Tom. Except there didn't seem to be all that much to focus on. Our younger son just seemed to stay on track. Most of the time, if he understood why a rule was in place, he'd follow it. Maybe Dylan wasn't as demonstrative, cuddly, or communicative as he had been when he was younger. What teenage boy is? But until he hit a patch of trouble in his junior year, I saw nothing, nothing, in our life together as a family to foreshadow the tragedy to come. Chapter 7 One Mother to Another. Journal Entry, May 1999. Today I began the task of writing condolence letters to the victims' families. It was so hard. The tragic loss of all those children. It's so hard, but it's something I must do. From the heart of one mother to another. Ever since childhood, I have found comfort in being helpful. My grandfather threw huge picnics at the farm he owned for the people who worked at his company and for the charities he supported, and I made myself useful by rounding up paper plates and empties. At school, I preferred to help the lunch ladies clean the cafeteria than to go out to the playground at recess. I'm still like this. "Put me to work," I say at a wedding, and I keep saying it until the host hands me something to pass or to pour. But there was absolutely nothing I could do to help anyone else in the aftershock of the carnage and cruelty committed by my son at Columbine High School. Concerned friends and clergy wanted to bring the families together, but the first lawsuit had been filed days after the tragedy, and our attorneys rejected the idea of face-to-face meetings outright. I can't imagine anyone involved would have wanted to meet with me so soon after the shootings, either. People urged Tom and me to make a public statement through the media. We did, a few days after the tragedy, apologizing as well as expressing our bewilderment and grief. Even so, I felt compelled to communicate directly with the families of Dylan's victims and to the victims who had survived. I decided to handwrite letters of apology to each of the families. I wasn't foolish enough to believe there were any words that could ever suffice, but I needed to let the families know the depth of my sorrow for what they had suffered at my son's hand. I had the idea that if I could extend some kindness, it might counterbalance Dylan's cruelty on that horrific morning. And although there's nothing noble about it, I wanted them to know that although I had loved him, I was not my son. Writing those letters remains one of the hardest things I have ever done. It took me a full month to finish them. How could I convey empathy when even hearing my name would likely increase the suffering these families were feeling? How could I reach out as a companion in sorrow when my son, the person I had created and loved more than life, was the reason they were in agony? How do you say, "I'm sorry my child killed yours"? The difficulty of writing the letters was compounded by the conflict it created within our own family. Tom was against the idea. He worried that sending an apology would be tantamount to accepting personal responsibility. Learning about the victims and how they died was excruciating for him, and he avoided it. I felt differently. If hearing from me might bring some small measure of comfort and open the door for communication with the families, it was a chance I wanted to take. I had to do something. I hoped showing my own humanity might bring an iota of peace to people who would be forever tormented by the cruelty of what my son had done. I had been deliberately avoiding news coverage, but in order to write to the families, I needed to know more about their loved ones. So I forced myself to read newspaper articles for information about the teacher and each of the children who had been killed. I never, ever wanted to dehumanize the individuals who had been killed or injured by thinking of them as a collective group, the victims. In each case, I needed to know the particular specific treasure that had been lost. Sorrow piled on sorrow with every biographical detail I read. Learning what each person had been interested in and what their friends and loved ones said about them broke my heart. The waste of it. The idea that Dylan had robbed innocent people of their precious lives and of the futures they should have had was intolerable. How could he have inflicted such pain? How could anyone raised in our home have done this? At times, writing the letters felt like standing dangerously close to a fire, and sometimes I had to step back. Each day, I wanted to run as fast as I could from the task in front of me. But if I did, I knew I would lose my connection to what had happened. Columbine had already become the lightning rod it still is, a symbol in a single word for the hazards of bullying, mental illness, irresponsible parenting, guns. Like everyone else, I believed there were answers to be pursued, but I was not yet ready to take refuge in abstractions. Columbine wasn't about guns or bullying. It was about the 15 people who were now dead, and the 24 who had been injured, some profoundly. Yet even while I was trying to write coherent letters, acknowledging my son's responsibility, I was clinging ferociously to my denial that Dylan could have been responsible for killing anyone. As I wrote them, I believed with all my heart that the people who sustained mortal wounds had been shot by Eric, not by Dylan. In the letters, I referred to the role Dylan had played in the tragedy, because I still didn't know what had really happened that day. Only the people had been killed and wounded. I referred to a moment of madness, because I believed Dylan had to have acted on impulse. It was inconceivable his participation could have been planned ahead of time. I could not yet believe my son was a murderer, because I did not accept that his intent had been to kill. I feared that many of the families would be insulted by my presumption in reaching out. They would say, correctly, that I did not have the right even to utter their loved one's name. When I read the first drafts of the letters I had written, I almost threw them away. The words on the paper were shamefully, pitifully inadequate. But writing them was all I could think of to do. I could not undo what Dylan and Eric had done. I could not bring back the lives that had been lost, nor heal those who had been wounded physically or psychologically. I was powerless to dampen the aftershocks of the tragedy for myself or anyone else, and I understood I could not control how people would respond. I was not asking for forgiveness or for understanding or for anything, except the chance to say that I was sorry. Journal entry, May 1999. Read today that Mr. Rohrbaugh had destroyed Dylan and Eric's crosses. I don't blame him at all. No one should expect the grieving families of victims to embrace Dylan and Eric now. I'd feel the same way. A week after the shootings, my brother Phil came to spend a few days with us. My sister couldn't join him. One of her teenage children, Dylan's cousin, had been so traumatized by the news of Dylan's role that she needed medical attention. Phil had come to comfort us, but what could he say or do? We were shadow people, ghosts of ourselves, moving through a never-ending twilight characterized by discombobulation, shame, and sorrow. Our days were consumed with legal appointments and the paranoid measures we followed in order to avoid the media and those who might want to harm us. Dylan's face was everywhere. Murderer, terrorist, neo-Nazi, outcast, scum. Soon after the shootings, we received yet another terrible shock. It was reported that Robin, Dylan's prom date, had bought 3 guns for the boys. My first thought was, oh no, poor Robin. In a flash, I could see it. She had done it because they'd asked her to. Because she liked them, because she was a nice person. She would never, ever, ever have done it if she'd believed it was unsafe. She's going to have to live with this for the rest of her life, I thought. Then, for the 1,000th time, look how many people they've hurt. The aftershocks kept coming. Still, mostly insulated from news and the outside world, I was only dimly aware of most of them. I didn't know until a year later that Marilyn Manson had canceled concert dates in our area out of respect, or that the NRA did not cancel their annual meeting, held at a hotel 15 miles away from the school, just 10 days after the shootings. I did learn that school authorities and police had been told about Eric's website, the one Judy Brown had told me about on the terrible day of the shootings, and that he'd talked openly on the site about pipe bombs and killing people. And I saw Dylan on the cover of Time magazine, next to the headline, "The Monsters Next Door." Despite the monstrous nature of what he had done, it hurt me terribly to see that word used to describe him, and utterly surreal to see his face under the iconic logo. It was still hard to believe Dylan had done something horrendous enough that the neighbors would know about it, let alone the entire world. I read the article. The next day I wrote, "Depression really kicked in when I read the Time magazine article yesterday. They made Dylan sound human, like a nice kid gone astray. This hurts more than the villain portrayal because it shows how totally senseless it all was. He didn't have to do any of this. He was so close to a life away from high school. If he was depressed, he didn't show us." A makeshift memorial had been erected in town, consisting of 15 rough-hewn wooden crosses, one for each person who had died, including Dylan and Eric. Immediately, Dylan's and Eric's crosses were chopped down and thrown in a dumpster. A church group planted 15 commemorative trees in a circle on their property, and police and congregation members stood helplessly by while two were felled. Of course, I understood why people did not want Dylan and Eric to be mourned or memorialized, but this unchallenged display of anger frightened us. Within a few days of his arrival, my brother accepted an offer to sleep at a neighbor's house. He urged us to leave with him, saying, "You're in such a state of shock. You can't see how dangerous this is." We were in shock, but the bigger issue was that we just didn't care. One particularly bad night, Tom said wearily, "I wish he'd killed us too." It was a thought we would have on many occasions over the years. A reporter got a hold of our phone records and called everyone we'd communicated with over the previous months. Our friends and family members were already inundated, but now the press started showing up at the two apartment buildings we owned to question our tenants. We'd worked hard to build a family business, and the safety and comfort of our tenants was a priority. But they were being harassed simply because they'd had the misfortune of moving into one of our properties. We didn't see a way to protect them, so we moved forward to sell the buildings. We considered leaving the area, but as hostile as the larger world was toward us, our own inner circle became an invaluable source of support. For more than a decade, our lives had been in Littleton, and the people we loved rallied immediately to our side. On days when I wasn't sure I would survive, friends materialized to keep me going. If God sends us love on earth, I truly believe it is delivered through the actions of people. During that terrible time, we were sustained by the care of those around us. Friends and family members were stalwart with daily calls and hugs. Neighbors delivered home-cooked meals and returned empty serving dishes to their rightful owners. Our friends quickly learned to stop defending us in the press after so many of them saw their words distorted or put into a negative context. But they fiercely protected our property, not only from the media's intrusions, but from any stranger who appeared. In the early days, when our phone rang off the hook with interview requests and calls from strangers as well as friends, 20 or 30 calls a day, our closest neighbors bought us a caller ID device so we'd know when it was safe to pick up. After that, we screened every call. On Mother's Day, after the shootings, a friend who was a talented gardener scoured the bargain section at a local nursery. When I returned home, I was greeted by a profusion of spring color from the neglected pots on my porch, verbena, petunias, dianthus, lobelia, marigolds. It was a gift of beauty and of herself, and it provided me with the surprising news that I could still appreciate such a thing. In order to cope with our grief and to piece together what had been going on in Dylan's mind, we needed to talk with people who'd known him. But I had no desire to put any of our friends in a position where they might be forced to testify in a trial. We were not supposed to talk about anything with legal significance, but everything had legal significance. I'm naturally forthcoming and was used to sharing my thoughts freely with the people I cared about. Our lawyer told me I could talk about my own feelings, and so I did. The people around me were kind enough to listen, even when I told the same stories over and over again. All I could do was take and not give back. I had never needed the kindness of others more than I did at that time, and I never did a poorer job of expressing my gratitude. This feeling added to my pervasive sense of guilt. My short-term memory had disappeared. I couldn't remember whom I'd thanked or if I'd said anything at all to express my appreciation. I kept a notebook to help me remember what I had said and done, but I'm still convinced I failed to convey my gratitude to everyone who deserved it. By the end of our first week back home, we knew we couldn't leave Littleton. The people who knew Dylan before, who remembered the day he pitched a victorious no-hitter, who could laugh about the time he ate an entire bucket of KFC by himself, or who'd been put into stitches by one of his dry asides. They were there, too, willing to share their memories of him. How would we survive without them? Besides, could we ever truly run from this? There would never be a way to escape from the horror of what Dylan had done. No mere relocation could distance us from the truth or from its stain. No matter where we went, this horror would follow. Journal entry, April 1999. Wandering around the house alone, trying to function. In the early 1970s, I worked as an art therapist at a psychiatric hospital in Milwaukee. One day, I overheard Betty, one of our patients with schizophrenia, say, "I'm just sick and tired of following my face around." In the weeks and months after Columbine, Betty's phrase came often to my mind. As my state of shock began to lift incrementally, waves of negative emotions overwhelmed me, and I toggled among debilitating sorrow, fear, anger, humiliation, anxiety, remorse, grief, powerlessness, pain, and hopelessness. The feelings weren't new. They'd been my constant companions since I'd gotten that first message at my office from Tom. Whatever protective shield had minimized their impact in the earliest hours was becoming ever less efficient, though. As more days passed, the insulation keeping me from fully experiencing the reality of what Dylan had done began to fall away, and my emotions, when they came, were searing. I could no longer distance myself from the community's pain or pretend my son hadn't caused this agony. Seeing a photograph of a victim's funeral on the cover of the local paper would leave me unable to move under the crushing weight of my grief and regret. I could barely function. I had always been hyper-organized and efficient, the kind of person who loves nothing better than sailing through her daily to-do list. In the weeks following Columbine, if I got a single thing done in the course of a day, the dishwasher emptied, a bill paid, it was a good day. I couldn't yet go back to work, but my career in disability services had at least provided me with a context. The symptoms of intense grief, memory loss, attention deficit, emotional fragility, incapacitating fatigue are surprisingly similar to those resulting from traumatic brain injury. Some days, I worried I was losing my link to sanity. One morning, I sat on the edge of the bed trying to get dressed. I put one sock on, then stared into space for an hour before I could put on the other. It took me almost 4 hours to get dressed. Another afternoon, a friend called to see how I was doing. "I do nothing. Why am I so tired?" I asked, genuinely bewildered. She spoke from her own experience with loss. "You're not doing nothing. You're grieving, and it's hard work." My grief for Dylan was at the heart of everything. It would have been crushing under any circumstances, but it was further compounded by my lack of comprehension and by my feelings of guilt over the destruction he had wrought. My world had been rocked off its axis. Friends who knew I often turned to art in times of trouble brought me art books and new sketchbooks to tempt me, but it was impossible for me to open them. Wearing bright colors made me feel physically ill. A life once filled with work and family activities and house maintenance and art and friends had come to a screeching halt. The long evening walks I took with our neighbors in the cliffs surrounding our home provided my only relief. At the beginning of May, the school decided Dylan's closest circle of friends would not be allowed to attend their own graduation ceremony, scheduled for the end of the month. At first, the unfairness of the decision aroused a real anger in me, and a sense of protectiveness for Dylan's friends. They were good kids, and they were hurting too. Most of them had reached out to us to offer their support and to tell us they'd been as blindsided as we had been. A number of them had come over to our house, bearing photographs and videos of Dill and cards he'd given them. Zach's girlfriend, Devin, made a book for us of photographs and written memories, mounted on paper she'd made herself. There was Dylan, grinning while pushing Zach's dad into the pool. sporting a Hawaiian shirt and a bunch of Lays at a costume party Devin had thrown, clowning around with Zach and making a hokey thumbs-up sign for the camera. I spent hours poring over these artifacts, desperate for confirmation that the sensitive, fun-loving kid Tom and I remembered had been real. Upon reflection, my anger about graduation abated, and a grim resignation took its place. Who was I to be angry? Even on someone else's behalf, these were extraordinary circumstances. There was no manual for how to proceed in the wake of the worst school shooting in history. Afterward, Dylan's friends scattered like beads from a broken necklace. Not surprisingly, many of them suffered serious difficulties for years. Nate stopped by our house on his way out of town. He asked for an item to remember his friend by, a request that moved me, and I was happy to see him choose a pair of Dylan's sunglasses. They reminded us both of Dylan in happier times. But Nate had something to tell us, too. He'd seen Dylan give a large wad of money to a guy they worked with at Blackjack Pizza. When Nate pressed him, Dylan told him the money was for a gun. We were dumbfounded by this news. Even Tom was willing to finally express anger toward Dylan for lying to us. We had been clinging to the belief that Dylan was an innocent victim, ensnared by Eric at the last minute. And yet, here was evidence that he had taken an active role in buying a gun, more evidence that my son had not been the person I thought he was. A month after the shootings, I sent the letters I had written to the families of the people who had been killed. Our lawyer watched the news for a response. I still couldn't turn on the television. As we had expected, the families' reactions were wildly diverse. Some appreciated the effort. Others were angry. At least one of the families tore my letter up, unread. There was no single point of view. In the weeks and months and years to come, when an individual or family acted aggressively, it helped me to remember they did not necessarily represent all the families involved. I received two written responses from victims' families in the months that followed. One letter was from the teenage sibling of one of the murdered girls. She said she did not blame us for the tragedy, and I wept with sadness and joy. Then, on my birthday, 11 months later, we received a letter from the father of one of the boys who was killed in the school library. He reached out with compassion and said he wished he could help us in some way. The letter felt like a gift from heaven. We got permission from our lawyer to write back, but we did not meet for several years because of the many lawsuits against our family. The small sense of accomplishment I'd gained from sending the letters to the victims' families was short-lived. There were far more losses than the 13 who had been killed. I felt I also needed to write to the 24 others who had been injured. There were students who would never walk again, and those who would live in constant pain. After years of working with students living with disabilities, I had an idea of the hardships the injured students and their families would have to endure. I thought of the physical and psychological agony they must be experiencing, and the ongoing drain on financial resources. Some would have to adjust to new identities that would affect every aspect of their lives. Even if we were held financially responsible, there was not enough money in the world to relieve the suffering Dylan had caused. The second set of letters, to the families of surviving victims, took many more weeks for me to write than the first. Again, I was struck by the inadequacy of my message and by the flimsiness of mere words in the face of everything that had been lost. How dare I interject myself into their lives? But I felt I had to do something. Journal entry, May 11, 1999. I'm sick of waking up each day with a broken heart, of missing Dylan and wanting to scream loud enough to wake up from the nightmare my life has become. I want to hold Dylan in my arms again, to cuddle him as I did years ago, to hold him in my lap and help him with his shoes or a puzzle. I want to talk to him and stop him from even considering this horrible act. There is a scene at the end of the movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Indiana Jones is tied back-to-back to the heroine of the movie. They can do nothing but close their eyes as vicious flying spirits unleash a storm of destruction around them. Tom and I were similarly tied to each other, utterly exposed and unable to escape.